Welcome to the fifth and final episode of the Women in the Can competition season of the Seventh Row podcast. I'm your host, Orla Smith, executive editor of Seventh Row, and I'm joined by my co-host, Alex Heaney, editor-in-chief of Seventh Row.
Hello.
This year is the first year that Can has put five films directed by women in competition, more than any previous year. They're still far from gender parity, but we wanted to take this opportunity to celebrate the wonderful women filmmakers and their films that have been fettered by the competition, both this year and in the past. This week, we're going to talk about the 2022 Cannes Film Festival, what films by women were programmed, what we thought of them, and the many, many fuck-ups of the festival, which proves it's an out-of-date institution which could care less about equality, gender, or otherwise. There's still time to catch up with our first four episodes of this season. Episode 1 gave a breakdown of the Cannes Film Festival and how it works in its history of programming women directors or not programming them. Episode 2 dived deep into Kelly Reichardt, her work and her history with Cannes. We'll be talking a little bit about that today. Episode 3 was a deep dive into Celine Sciamma, her history with Cannes and why she's still so underappreciated. And episode 4 was dedicated to Nomi Kawase, the darling of Cannes, who has had more films programmed in competition this century than almost any other filmmaker, and certainly more than any other woman. Just a reminder that alongside this season, we have been promoting our Women in the Cannes competition box set, which is a box set of 3 ebooks, all of them about a woman who has been fettered by the Cannes competition. We have our ebook about Kelly Reichardt, Rose to Nowhere, our ebook about Celine Sciamma called Portraits of Resistance, and our ebook, You Were Never Really Here, a special issue, which dives deep on Lynn Ramsey's film. So you can find that box set at 7th-row.com/womenatcannesboxset. That deal for 3 for the price of 2 is available for just a few more days from the release of this episode, so you can get it until June 10th, so hurry to get your books.
So where should we begin with how badly the Cannes Film Festival fucked up this year?
Well, should we start with Kelly Reichardt, because we talked about her in episode 2. Basically, the Cannes competition, unlike some festivals which sort of front load their larger titles, Cannes programs a few competition titles a day throughout the entire run of the festival. However, it's very known that like critics tend to start leaving around midway through the second week, with the festival ending, with the last film screening on Friday, and then the awards being announced on Saturday, and there's a bunch of sort of screenings, like second or third or whatever screenings of titles that screen throughout the festival on the Saturday. But the last premieres are on Friday. And if you are one of the last premieres on the Friday, that means like you're not gonna get seen by many people because most people are home.
So most films, the way it works is you get sort of a 48 hours in the sun, and then there's the repeat screening. So there's screenings the day that it premieres, then there are day after screenings, then the film disappears until the end of the festival. But if your film doesn't premiere until the very last day, there's no day after screening. The day after screening is the rerun screening. Most people are gone by Wednesday. The festival knows this. So while they don't obviously front-load the starry titles in the same way as, say, like, TIFF or Venice does, where literally nothing is premiering by, you know, the last 5 days, there is absolutely, like, a deliberate choice to, like, where your slot is certainly a political thing.
Yeah, and we've talked a lot about how this is the most women that Cannes have ever programmed this year, with 5 women in competition. And there's about just over 20 films in competition, with 5 of them being by women. And 2 of those were screened on the final day. And that feels to me a little bit pointed.
Yeah, I like not just the final day, but the last 2 slots on the final day. And I mean, the only way you could get your film to screen earlier was to, 1, have a male co-director, 2, be a famous French actress who is also really beautiful and thus will you know, take great photos on the red carpet. And three, and this is just so you don't get shoved to the very, very end as if you're Claire Denis. You're still like, lots of people won't see it, but you're not shoved to the last slot on the last day, which would suck any year, but this year everybody would have had COVID. I mean, they would have gone to the movies anyway. They just would have had COVID. And so then you could also have the distinction of being a super spreader.
You're right. The hierarchy is so clear. Yeah. Within how they programmed those five films by women.
Yeah.
You know, because the last two female directors who screened were Kelly Reichardt and...
Leonore Serre.
Yes. They're both just film directors rather than also being actresses, which is the case for Claire Denis. But, like, to not be shoved to the end, you have to be Claire Denis, someone who has, like, made, like... 15 plus films over the course of several decades, and like probably should have been in the Cannes competition many, many more times than she has been, which is two. This was her second. That standard is pretty depressing.
Well, and basically by Thursday, the jury's already made up their mind. Like, quite apart from will any press see your film and will your film get any press coverage whatsoever, like, the jury's made up their mind. And they like, what happens if you win an award is you get called back to the festival. So a lot of people, they go home, you know, the day or two after their film premieres. And then if they get an award, they have to fly back or take the train back or, you know, obviously more complicated if you're coming from Australia than if you're coming from Denmark or Sweden. But Ruben Östlund was hanging around on the Croisette on Thursday, which would suggest he already knew he was winning an award. I mean, they got to give you like some notice, right? They can't just tell you Saturday morning, come back.
And I mean, I think it's interesting because I think the Kelly Reichardt film, for example, was already at somewhat of a disadvantage because sort of as could have been predicted, the reception of it tends to indicate that it's sort of quite a low-key film, as Kelly Reichardt's films tend to be. Like, it's a film about an artist who isn't super successful, going about her day-to-day life. If you look at the reception, it was overall quite positive, but it was also not very loud at all, partly because of the numbers thing and partly because I think Cannes audiences, with like the way people talk about what a great Cannes film is, favours large statements. And Kelly Reichardt is not a filmmaker of large statements. And this film in particular seems to be one that, like, is not a large statement, which doesn't make it any less valuable or good.
Yeah, I think this year's selection in competition, from what I hear, I only have a sample size of the two competition films I've seen, of which this is true, is that the just generally the selection favored really long films. Some of which were, like, trying to be epics. Some of which needed a better editor. And, like, you know a Kelly Reichardt film is not going to be too long.
Yes, because she is also a great editor.
Crisply edited, so she's not going to get the, oh, it's 3 hours long, it must be a masterpiece.
I mean, it is an hour and 48 minutes, typical Kelly Reichardt film.
Can't be a masterpiece under 2 hours. Generally speaking, I don't know that festivals are great launch pads for really thoughtful films. It's just they need the festivals, you know, but critics are tired and have seen 1,000 movies. And the worst thing you can do is put like a thoughtful movie at the end of the program because no one has any energy left. Like, you hit burnout. So even if it's a film that you might have loved or given a chance to on day one or day two, by day 10, it's like... maybe I would have loved this film, but I'm not in the brain space to give it the attention it deserves. Yeah, I mean, like, maybe if it had played Director's Fortnight and opened Director's Fortnight instead of using the Carastar to barter for a spot in competition, maybe it would have done better because it would have been early in the festival. People would have still been really excited for new films and... then this would have been a delight rather than at the end of the festival when people are kind of just done.
And it wouldn't be like being judged against films that are trying to be epics, watching, if you're someone who watches all the films in competition, you're judging them all by the same measuring stick, and they're doing quite different things.
There's a lot of things going on here too. Like, let's not forget that Lucas Daunt, who made Close and won, shared the Grand Prix with Claire Denis about 3 years ago. He won the Camera d'Or for making a movie about a trans girl starring a cis boy.
Which is also a film that was offensive in ways other than its casting. Yeah. Its casting was merely the first problem.
Yeah, exactly.
But obviously, it was the thing about that film, Girl, his first film, is that it was lauded at Cannes, and
yeah,
it wasn't until
it
reached it wasn't until it reached overseas audiences that the critiques of the film started like being heard. Because Cannes was not going to be an audience that was, and this is a lot of what we're talking about in this season, is Cannes was not going to be an audience that was perceptive to and critical of things like transphobia, just as it's not a festival that is warm to or receptive to films by and about women or indigenous people, etc., etc.
I think they just are so backwards. It's not even necessarily that they're not receptive. It's that they don't even understand what they're watching. I'm less surprised, though, that Cannes is a great launching place if you want to make a super fucking colonialist movie and get lauded for it. Chloe Zhao. <Right. laughs> To be fair, Sundance gave her the lunch pad first.
Right. There's such an idea of Cannes as this sort of sacred place for cinema, and it's held up in that way that I feel people being reluctant to, like, think critically about it as an institution, and that can also extend to, like, thinking critically about the politics of the films that it programs.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it, but part of what I'm saying is it's a self-selecting audience, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you try to... So, War Pony, which I haven't seen, but it's a movie with an entirely indigenous cast directed by two white settler ladies, so let's just say I have my suspicions.
One of whom is Elvis's granddaughter. Just to say that she is extremely rich.
Yeah. Good point. Two rich white settler ladies. That film is going to have a different reception if it tried to play in Canada. Now, there's still lots of ignorant critics in Canada who have embraced all kinds of terrible stuff about Indigenous people by white settlers, or just settlers. They don't have to be white. Chloe Zhao. Let's just say that's not a film I see Imaginative, the biggest Indigenous film festival in the world, programming. And there's a reason for that. And if you played that film somewhere where a substantial Indigenous audience could see it, like, say, the Vancouver Film Festival or the Toronto Film Festival, there is just going to be a different reception in audiences than people who are like, oh my God, I've never even seen an Indigenous person. Did you know that they're still alive? Did you know that they live in houses? Did you know that they use guns for hunting? Because I saw Nanook of the North and I thought that was how the Inuit live.
Well, it's also like Cannes, like, being the opposite of a festival for the people, in the sense that, like, you can't be public and attend unless you, like, beg for tickets on the street. But you, like, it's a festival for industry and for press and for stars. And, you know, it doesn't invite in members of the public who can offer a non-extremely wealthy point of view on the films that are screening.
And I mean, this year, where there was actually a delegation from Canada's Indigenous Screen Office and Telefilm Canada, which brought a bunch of Indigenous filmmakers to the festival, there was a big scandal because the Dene filmmaker, Kelvin Redvers, had the audacity, apparently, to wear moccasins on the red carpet when he was attending the screening of Forever Young. I say audacity, apparently, because this is formal wear. Cannes is just too Eurocentric and ignorant to be aware of that. And he was kicked off the red carpet and it caused a huge scandal. So, I mean, these are the people that are programming the films. So, big shock, they're going to program colonialist bullshit. Like, look, mm-hmm. I could be proven wrong about War Pony. I just see this as highly unlikely. because to date, I have never seen a film about Indigenous people made by a settler that didn't scream, "I was made by a settler."
And it's not to mention sort of like, I mean, there has been, I think, a bit more coverage this year of the inequities in Cannes. And there's also been a report written in Deadline recently, which I'll link in the show notes, about the treatment of Black attendees at Cannes. And there's, like, unsurprisingly, yet more like stories of red carpet wear policing there as well. Like one about sort of a Black film critic attending who was kicked off the red carpet for wearing a white suit, even though there were plenty of white attendees wearing white suits who weren't reprimanded for the same thing, because apparently they're not allowed white suits. I don't know. Ask Cannes and their ridiculous dress code.
Well, and this is years after getting bad press for Heelgate, right? When they decided women have to wear high heels unless their name is Kristen Stewart.
Yeah. So that, you know, that dress code has always been incredibly regressive. But then in this report, there's all sorts of other, like, reports of microaggressions, like being screamed at, being targeted for quote-unquote randomized bag checks. Yeah, it's a whole clusterfuck. And the evidence is overwhelming that, like, in the films themselves and in the physical space of Cannes, like, inequality is everywhere. Although in terms talking about the films themselves, like, I like Brett's quote in our first episode in this season where he talks about how the festival has sort of like political alibis in filmmakers like the Dardens and Ken Loach that they program a lot. And the Dardens did in fact win a made-up award this year.
Which was hilarious. It was like they heard what Brett said and wanted to prove him right. Like, can't get to give the Dardenne a real award, but we want to make sure that we know, they know, and everyone else knows that we care about poor people. So let's make up a prize for them.
Yeah, they made up a prize called the Special Prize for Cannes 75th Anniversary to give to Tori and Lakita, which was their film in competition. And it's, you know, one of the, like, films in the competition that is highly political in a way that Cannes as a festival absolutely is not.
Well, it's political, just in a very...
bad way.
Rich people, right-wing, progressive way.
I mean, they even had, like, Zelensky in their opening ceremony, which is slightly bizarre, which gives sort of, like, the whiff of caring about the world and politics, as does the films that they program, like programming films with a political edge. But then when you look at the institution of Cannes itself, it doesn't care about people who aren't rich and white and male. But before we talk about some of the films we did see, it's probably worth sort of mentioning what did win. And especially as we've been talking about these five films that were directed by women in competition, it's worth noting that two of them won prizes. The Eight Mountains won the jury prize, and Claire Denis, as you've mentioned, shared the Grand Prix.
Eight Mountains shared the jury prize with Io. Although I feel like Jerzy Skolimowski, you know, deserved it just for his opening speech.
He thanked all his donkeys.
I would like to thank all my donkeys, all six of them.
But I think it is notable that, like, as you said, it was, the jury prize was shared as well, and it's, again, it feels, whether it was intentional or not, it feels pointed that two women won prizes, but only ones that were able to be shared by men. And it feels quite emblematic, I think, of all the things we've been talking about, where, like, for example, there were only three films by women programmed in competition initially, and then they added two extra. But then two of the films were pushed to the very end of the festival where no one could see them. It feels very, like, the crumbs we're getting, even them feel very kind of, like, performative and not particularly meaningful.
I think it's also worth just, like, briefly touching on the jury. Because it's one thing to complain about the awards as though this is, like, Terry Frémaux's fault, which it sort of is. But it's not like the people who run Cannes pick the awards, but they pick the jury. and the jury is a hand-picked insular group of, like, Cannes favorites doing victory laps. And more or less, it's mostly male directors and actresses. And if the actresses happen to have directed a movie, great, because they look slightly less sexist for picking them.
I mean, it tends to be generally gender equity on the jury, but as you said, that only tells half the story because, like you said, the women are actresses in general and the men are filmmakers, which is not to denigrate actresses necessarily, yeah, but it says something about the way that Cannes views women's place within the film industry, not as the head of the ship or not as the storytellers, but as like the pretty faces on screen.
You know, I think we both are really big fans of Rebecca Hall, not just as an actress, but as a director. We can't wait to see what she does next. Mm-hmm. I think she's a good screenwriter too, but especially a good director. But when you look at the history of the Cannes Film Festival, it does make me ask myself, yeah, but is she on the jury because she's a beautiful actress?
Well, if she had made her directorial debut of Passing last year and had no history as an actress, I can guarantee you she wouldn't be on that jury.
And then, like, the directors are all people who have been in competition before, like Joachim Trier on his victory lap from Worst Person in the World last year. Asghar Farhadi, who's always in competition, basically, no matter what he comes up with. Jeff Nichols, who is one of those, like, why the hell was he anointed by Cannes directors?
Yeah. But you've got Vincent Lindon as the jury president in his victory lap. From last year with Titane, but Titane was directed by Julia Ducournau. And you have to wonder, like, perhaps she was offered a place in the jury and couldn't take it or turned it down. But it's interesting that he's the one that represents the film in that victory lap.
Yep, sure is.
And then the Palme d'Or winner, which we briefly mentioned, was Triangle of Sadness, Ruben Östlund's film, which is just bizarre because he last won the Palme d'Or just, was it 5 years ago with, yes, The Square?
Yeah.
And it was his previous film. He hasn't even made a film in between.
He does not need another Palme d'Or. Like, I just can't believe that this movie is the greatest thing since sliced bread. Even if it's a great film, it's maybe still a bad reason to give him a Palme d'Or, who's already, like, high on his own bullshit. And decided after winning the Palme d'Or, he would release a longer version of the film after previously announcing he was going to edit the film post-Cannes.
Now, that's a thing that Kelly Reichardt wouldn't do.
No, but, like, I mean, that's the thing. Like, what? He doesn't need that showcase. If you're, like, picking the Palme d'Or, the big thing you get out of a Palme d'Or, where it's political, is it can help a film that needs the help, that wouldn't get the same attention. Like, if they'd given The Eight Mountains the Palme d'Or, suddenly that film would have visibility, and it doesn't have distributors yet, or EO. Or if they'd given Kelly Reichardt the Palme d'Or, or Clara Denis the Palme d'Or, like, I haven't seen those films, but obviously that would be huge. It would be a huge political statement, but it'd also be huge for their careers. And for those films, and Ruben Östlund does not need another fucking Palme d'Or.
Wouldn't it be, like, giving Kelly Reichardt the Palme would be a huge statement on, like, what kind of cinema is valuable.
Yeah.
Because, like, her films are sort of quiet looks at the interior lives of women generally, or sensitive men. Like, Triangle of Sadness, like, I'm very open to it being a film I might enjoy.
Yeah, like, I expect I'll probably like it. I've usually been, I'm not a huge fan of his films, but I usually enjoy them.
From what it sounds like quite a long, absurdist, quite on the nose class critique, which is not unwelcome, but is also a bit, it sounds to me a little bit, like, broader than something that, say, like, a filmmaker like Kelly Reichardt might do. It sounds a bit more like, this is very obviously political in a way that, like, we can look good for rewarding.
Well, also, we've seen The Square and we know how thoughtful he is about class critiques.
It sounds a bit like The Square, in
which
a way.
Which is to say, not very rich white men, generally not that bright about class critiques.
Yeah, and look, I'm excited to see Harris Dickinson in a comedy because we know from his tiny part in Mateus and Maxine that he is comedy gold.
Oh, absolutely.
But it just strikes me as a film. It was so bizarre to hear it announced as the winner because it of all the competition, it seems like one of the films that least needs a win. It makes the least sense to give it to it. So, but it just strikes me as such a very easy option. We have created a special box set of books that we previously wrote about women who have featured in the Cannes competition. The Women in Cannes competition box set includes books about three women directors who have been selected for the competition over the years. There are also three of our favourite filmmakers, Lynn Ramsey, Celine Sciamma, and this year, Kelly Reichardt. Get your copy of the Women in Cannes competition box set at 7th-row.com/womenatcannes. That's C-A-N-N-E-S. On our Kelly Reichardt ebook, Roads to Nowhere, Kelly Reichardt's Broken American Dreams, Claudio Alves of The Film Experience said, "As a Kelly Reichardt fan, I can't recommend Roads to Nowhere enough." On our Celine Sciamma book, Portraits of Resistance, film critic Alfred Soto commented, "Erudite and casual, Portraits of Resistance will force readers into running back to watch every Sciamma film to see what they missed." On our Lynn Ramsey book, You Were Never Really Here, A Special Issue, Brian Tallarico of RogerEbert.com wrote, "Seventh Row's ebook allows for a deeper appreciation of a brilliant piece of art. It's what we want more from critical analysis, a conversation with the art and its creators, but so rarely get." Get your copy of the Women in Cannes competition box set at 7th-row.com/womenatcannes. Now we're going to talk a little bit about some of the films that we saw. I've realised we've not actually said this explicitly yet, but just to state that neither me or Alex actually attended Cannes in person, which is why our opinions on a lot of the larger titles are limited, which is because we haven't seen most of them. But we did manage to watch and cover quite a lot of the sort of non-competition slate, whether that's En Certain Regard or the Critics Week or the Director's Fortnight sidebars. So we'll talk about some of the films by women that we really loved now.
So yeah, among Critics Week, there were 7 films in competition, and we saw 3 of them, and there were 4 films out of competition, and we've seen 3 of them. And I did not like any of the films in competition in Critics Week. I saw La Joria, which won. I saw Almaviva, which was, like, fine. But maybe just watch Summer 1993 instead. And you saw Love According to Dalva.
Yeah, and I think Love According to Dalva is an interesting debut. It's essentially about a 12-year-old girl who has been sexually abused by her father. And we meet her just as she's taken away from her father. So it's all about the aftermath. And it's a film that makes me curious about this filmmaker because she portrays that quite sensitively, and she portrays the sort of coming to terms with that process sensitively. But the film is also sort of narratively a bit straightforward and a bit narrow in like what it's trying to explore. So it's not a film I loved, but it's Critics Week is basically a section for first or second time filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And in that remit, you know, it made me curious about a filmmaker.
It seems like After Sun was the big breakout of the section, which we weren't able to see because MUBI already bought it up.
And A24 will be releasing it in the US.
And that stars Paul Mescal, who obviously we are fans of and talk a lot about how great his performance is in Normal People in our episode from whenever that was, like 2 years ago?
2020. Mm-hmm. And that's by a British filmmaker, by a Scottish filmmaker, Charlotte Wells, which is exciting. I'm very excited to see that film because it is rare that like a directorial debut that's like out, not in competition at Cannes, becomes like kind of the talk of Cannes. I guess it says something about the quality of the film, hopefully.
I think the special screenings, which tend to be, actually, I don't totally understand how they work. I think some of them are second films, and then, like, I don't know why certain things are special screenings instead of in competition, but they tend to fare slightly better, because, like, last year, two of the special screenings were Anaïs in Love, which we loved, and A Tale of Love and Desire, which I loved. You can read my review of that on the site.
I didn't not love it, I just haven't seen it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry. Wasn't saying that you thought it was bad or anything. You just haven't seen it yet. And I'm kind of into the fact that Critics Week seems to be keen on programming these sort of, like, light existential comedies by and about women. So Anaïs in Love was last year's, and this year's is Everybody Loves Jean by first-time filmmaker Celine Deveaux. And a few years back, they programmed In Bed with Victoria, which is the Justine Triet wackadoodle comedy with Virginie Efira and Vincent Lacoste. Do you want to say something about Everybody Loves Jean? I mean, I really liked it.
You were sort of comparing it a bit to also Ninja Baby, which is about a younger character, but they both use like illustration within the film to... And like an illustrated character that represents sort of the voice in the character's head. And in this case, it's her insecurities, essentially, like telling her what a terrible person she is. And Jean is a really interesting character. Like she's, what's her job exactly?
Well, I don't know that she has one anymore. she had designed some kind of innovative machine to clean up ocean plastics and put up everything she owned to pay as collateral, and then there's an epic fail and a video of her jumping into the water called Epic Fail that we see at the beginning, which is the end of her career and her financial stability. So when we meet her, she's trying to figure out how she's going to pay off her debtors and what the hell happens with the rest of her life now that her career is down the toilet.
I always love a film with a character that has an unconventional career, like you know, a job that you don't see in films much, because so often films like just don't give their characters jobs at all, or they give them you'll see them like type in a computer or in the phone like, oh, it's blah blah blah, asked me to look at this account, blah blah blah, and you're like, oh, I guess I have a job, like generic job speak. But like Jean has like a very specific job that like really plays into her story and is a big part of her story, and she's also failed at it in an interesting and spectacular way. Like you said, it's kind of an unconventional portrait of this woman who's at a stage in her life where she feels like she should be doing a lot better than she is. It creates a full life for her with so many different characters and relationships that she's dealing with. Yeah, no, I think you're right that it fits into a trend in the Critics Week sidebar that I always find very refreshing.
Yeah, it seems to be a new trend, but I'm very here for it. They're all French movies too, and it's kind of like part rom-com, part story dealing about her grief about her mother's death, part family story about her relationship with her brother, and part like what happens with the career fail. And the other film that was of note is July Jung's second film, Next So He, which is the closing film of the section, which is kind of doing a sort of Ken Loach thing. It's flawed, but like I really admire what it's trying to do. About it sort of takes place in two parts. The first part is about this young woman, I guess she's probably still a teenager, who's got this work placement at an incredibly abusive job, and she gets really depressed, and lots of people end up killing themselves at that job, and so does she. And the second half of the film follows the police investigator who's investigating her suspected suicide, who like follows the path of corruption and is like, I don't even know who to arrest anymore because everyone is corrupt and, you know, reporting to somebody higher up where the corruption really is. So it's like very righteously angry. And also, if you've ever tried to cancel, say, your internet service, you will recognize the interactions in this film and be like, that is exactly how predatory these companies are.
And it's actually like the in the past 12 months of the second film we've seen at film festivals, the second Korean film we've seen at film festivals, about the pressures of working at a call center company and the badness of capitalism, because we had Aloners at TIFF last year, which I also really liked and was also a very sharp social critique. So that's a trend for you.
The other one we saw is Jesse Eisenberg's When You Finish Saving the World, which we saw at Sundance. And if you want to hear us complain about that, you can listen to our Sundance
episode. It was okay.
It's
a film that does some things very well and some things not particularly well. So take that as you will.
I would say, though, that the director's Fortnite programming was pretty, like, really strong on the whole. Like, most of my favorite films that I saw at the festival were in director's Fortnite. The one big exception being Plan 75 and Seltan Ragar, which we haven't gotten to yet, but we will. And we didn't even see things by some of our favorite directors, like Liam Macias, not sure how you pronounce her name, whose new film, The Five Devil, was in there, and Alice Winokur's new film, Paris Memories, was in there, and Maya Hansen-Love's new film, One Fine Morning, was in director's Fortnite. So we didn't even see those.
The treasure trove.
I'm still saying that it was really, really strong, just based on what we saw. There were a ton of really fantastic debut films. I guess I'll shout out to the Canadian film Falcon Lake, which is a really lovely coming of age story about sort of being on the precipice between childhood and adolescence and what that means when you have a crush but you also kind of just want a friend and you don't really know what you want or what your body is telling you. It's really, really thoughtful.
Directed by Charlotte Le Bon, of all people, the actress who I first became aware of as Philippe Petit's girlfriend in the movie The Walk.
I first became aware of her in Fresh at Sundance, so I'm not holding that terrible film against her.
Yeah.
No, I think she's really, really, it's interesting how many actresses in the last year who have become directors have proven to be really, really sensitive to blocking. I think her blocking is really, and framing is really fantastic. And obviously we've talked before about Rebecca Hall being in that category as well. Well, and you saw 1976, which I think was another great debut from Manuela Martelli, a Chilean film set during the Pinochet years. It's a film that's about this wealthy, middle-aged woman who basically comes face-to-face with a soon-to-be, could-be political prisoner, certainly a politically wanted man. And she first encounters him because her local priest tells her that there's this petty criminal who's injured, and she has had some experience with the Red Cross, and so he's hoping that she can help bandage this guy up. And she quickly figures out this guy is no petty criminal, he's a political criminal. And slowly but surely, like, the horrors of the Pinochet dictatorship kind of seep into her life. At first, it's just sort of whisperings that she hears among her household staff about disappearances or people washed up on the beach. And suddenly she's kind of playing spy to try and help this guy get in contact with his comrades so that he can find a safe place to stay. And it gets, I think the film is interesting in how it complicates her character, because we first meet her, she's like picking out paint colors for her wall. And so you see her and you assume, oh, this is just a vapid rich lady. And then, you know, there's the shock of, like, there's some screaming outside. So the guy who's mixing the paint stops abruptly and some paint ends up landing on her shoe. And that's sort of like the bit of a hammer over the head, but I think effective symbol of what's about what's going to happen. And then you find out that she's actually a lot more complicated than that, and that she wanted to be a doctor, but sexism and she got married instead. So you can feel like she wants to be a useful, she wants to be useful, and the fact that she becomes more and more aware of the horrors that are going on because of her involvement with trying to help this guy means that it's harder and harder for her to turn away from her own privileges, because we find out that she is a rich lady because her husband is a top surgeon in a hospital in Santiago, but he's one of Pinochet's sort of key men and beneficiaries. And so her life has kind of been paid for by Pinochet's crimes. And she is sort of stuck trying to deal with what that means and what her role is. And it's a really, really smart, very, very well made film. It's kind of incredible that it's a first feature. I reviewed Falcon Lake on the site, and Everybody Loves Sean from Critics Week. And then we should have a review of 1976 coming soon from Lindsay Pugh.
Mm-hmm.
I saw some good films by men in the director's court.
They don't deserve airtime. We just shout out like Continental Drift, we both saw and liked. And did you see any other good films by men?
Yeah, I mean, like Green Perfume was entertaining. It's nothing to write home about, but if you want to see like Vincent Lacoste being an actor,
I'm sold already. If you want to see Vincent Lacoste being
in a fabulous scarf, I mean, what more is there to want from cinema? Yeah, no, I think Continental Drift is worth talking about, because I think it's one of the few films at the festival that has a social conscience. It is about the migrant crisis in Europe, and about, it sort of takes place in a light dystopian early 2020, in which the EU is even more draconian in its migration policies, and its borders are closed. And it's about an EU officer dealing with the hypocrisy of her colleagues who are planning a visit to this migrant temporary housing facility and are turning it into a big show for virtue signaling, and she's disgusted by it. And along the way, the visit gets delayed because COVID's a coming, and so she gets to reconnect with her son, played by Theodore Pellerin, one of our faves. If you want to read the definitive profile on him / interview with him, you can do so on our site, courtesy of Justine Smith, and he is fantastic here. I mean, he's always fantastic, but he's not always given a part with as much meat to sink his teeth into as this one, which has both like some amazing comedy moments. He raps shirtless, is really into sandals, and he speaks German accented English, if that is not enough to get you excited about it.
It feels, if I said to you, it feels a bit like an alternate universe, like, version of the Jesse Eisenberg film. Hmm. Even though, like, the context is quite different. They're both about a mother and son who have, like, well, particularly the mother, and when you finish saving the world, have, like, political, like, social obligations to do with their work, and are also trying to, like, manage a relationship between the two of them and balancing those things. And they're kind of about the political and the personal, but I think that this film has a lot more to say about that than the Jesse Eisenberg film, even though I did quite like that film ish
yeah, I've mixed. Yeah, I more or less like that film, but I think this film is a lot smarter about the way that the personal is political, as opposed to the political being virtue signaling. Like, I think these two really care about the causes that they're working on, but they are not immune to human foibles and hypocrisies. And the film is really smart about the ways in which people are all hypocrites and have sort of the limits of empathy. And then In Certain Regard, I think the two best films from my perspective were Plan 75 and Corsage.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the best thing to do is to read your review of Plan 75, Alex, because it's very good. But in short, it's kind of like definitely catnip for the kind of films that we like. Like, it's a very interesting and original critique of societal structures. And it's set in a near future Japan, where there's a government program that basically it offers up the option of euthanasia to people who are over 75. And, you know, it's not forced or anything, but it's incredibly well funded, this thing called Plan 75. And the film follows three characters. One is an elderly woman over 75 who doesn't have much family or much of a social support system. One is a young Filipino woman who is at first working in a care home, but then chooses a job at Plan 75 because it pays better. She needs to send money back home to her family, and it follows a man who works at Plan 75 who reconnects with his uncle, right? It's his uncle. He has submitted himself for the Plan 75 program. So it's really, it's taking a many angle look at this system. Mm-hmm. And to take, like, especially with the I'd say the core story of this elderly woman over 75, does such a good job of showing the way that, like, in this society, people would be, they're given a choice to choose Plan 75, but they're pushed in, the various ways they're pushed into that choice, which is basically taking away all other social support, so that, you know, if you can't find housing, or if you don't have company, if you don't have employment, if those aren't options for you because those options aren't being funded or they're being taken away in various ways, then Plan 75 is this, like, shiny option where, like, oh, hey, you're lonely. Well, we have a call center where you can always be chatting with someone. Yeah. Or, like, we'll give
you... No regular mental health support, only if you're going to kill yourself.
Yeah, and then we'll give you, like, a bursary of money in the lead up to your death so that you can enjoy yourself. It deals with all your problems for the very short amount of time that it takes for you to die. And it's a very chilling look at, like... At first, the premise sounds like that wouldn't happen. You wouldn't have how could a government allow that? And then when you watch the film, it makes so much sense. And that's what's really chilling about the film. And it also kind of makes you think about how there are versions of this that already exist around the world in a bit more of an indirect way. But, like, you know, think about all the ways in which, like, certain, like, ways of being for, like, say, disabled people in certain countries, like, it's so difficult to live because there are no social support systems, and therefore, like, sometimes death seems like a more, like, a nicer option when you're not being given the opportunities to, like, live a comfortable life, even though a government could provide that. So I think it's a film that sort of, like, is like a bleak snapshot of the future but also of the present in lots mm-hmm. of ways.
It did get a special mention for the Camera d'Or, but come on, it should have won the Camera d'Or. I just don't believe that War Pony could be better. But yeah, I think it's interesting, like, Plan 75 and Continental Drift are doing similar things, and that they are both set in this sort of, like, light sci-fi future that's not really that sci-fi. Mm-hmm. Okay, Japan may not have Plan 75 yet, but Canada has medical-assisted dying, and next year, if you are depressed and want to die, the government will say, sure, how can we help? Not, how can we... And by how can we help is not, let me get you an appointment with a psychiatrist, it's let me get you some drugs to die.
Yeah.
Continental Drift is about the migrant crisis, and it depicts an EU that's a bit worse than it is today, but... I mean, it's one of the few films that actually incorporates COVID into it to sort of make the point that the migrant crisis has actually gotten worse since COVID. And Plan 75 also feels like a film that's particularly timely in the time of COVID. Not that we didn't have huge amounts of ageism before, but the rate at which countries are happily killing off the elderly by letting COVID run rampant makes Plan 75 extra chilling.
Mm-hmm. Or I mean, even the ways that, like, rather than investing money into, like, good ventilation of public spaces, et cetera, countries are more willing to just, like, let people become disabled. And yeah, then they also probably will then be more willing to encourage those people to die, or to just not support them at all and let them die. So there's, I mean, there's all sorts of ways you can extrapolate what you see in this film to real world scenarios without it being too much different from what we see in the film. In the film, it's just a bit more sort of formalized than a lot of these things we're talking about, and it's a bit more kind of like commercialized, but it's really not that different.
But I think, like, Continental Drift is a really good film about failures of empathy and how even the most passionate have apathy in ways that, and that, like, there's a short hop and a skip from apathy and failures of empathy to massive crimes against humanity. Mm-hmm. And Plan 75 is kind of similarly about how easy it is to prey upon, you know, parts of society that are neglected and make it even worse for them. And the more the problem can be out of sight, out of mind, the happier people are at least on the surface, until you eventually encounter it and it can screw you up. Mm-hmm. Which is what happens to all the young people in the film who somehow are employed by Plan 75. It really screws them up. Yeah, the other thing that's worth checking out is Corsage, which IFC has picked up in North America, and it's a new film from Marie Kreutzer. I reviewed her previous film, The Ground Beneath My Feet, which I really liked, and Corsage is kind of like all the exact same themes except transported to the 1800s and about Austrian royalty. Vicky Creeps tries to look like she's 40. And the film is about, like, what happens when your entire life has been dedicated to being an ornament and now you're 40 and it's a lot harder to just be the hot object on someone's arm. And also maybe you've had some life experience and think you have other things to offer and want to have more in life than pretty hair. And the sort of existential crisis that she goes through because of that. I mean, it's more, I think Cannes loves to program films, especially Celtin Regard, where they occasionally let women in. If your film is obviously like, the patriarchy, it's a bad, then Cannes is like, ooh, I like you. And if you dare to be a little bit naughty, it's kind of surprising that, naughty with a K, not N-A-U-G-H-T-Y. It's always surprising that, like, the film makes it through. I think this film is naughtier than you might expect in a thoughtful way. And I guess the only other one, like, I mean, I saw a bunch of other stuff that's not worth mentioning, but the one that is worth mentioning, I think, is The Eight Mountains, which tied for the jury prize and is a really wonderful kind of epic film about this friendship between these. They start off as two, I think, 12-year-old boys, and we follow them over like 30 years of friendship and how they come apart and come together and are disconnected and come together, and they kind of connect over, they meet when one of the boys is on summer vacation in a house they've rented in the mountains, which is where the other boy, who is from a poor family, lives. And it's about the ways in which they disconnect and connect over the course of their lives and the way time passes and you know, your life sort of gets away from you. And it's really beautifully made. Like, it's just absolutely gorgeous photography. It's shot by the guy who did Titan and Ra, so I suppose that should come as no surprise. And it's a really lovely story of friendship between two men. Luca Marinelli plays a clumsy guy, which is a surprising thing to hear if you've seen Martin Eden, because that is not something that I ever expected to see and believe. But there you go. He's very good in it. Yeah, I think it's really well directed, really well blocked. And it's one of the few films recently, I think Falcon Lake is another one that really uses the Academy ratio to help show like the distance between people and also this, when they become close to each other, because the frame is so narrow. And given all the landscapes in the film, you might not expect it to be an Academy ratio film instead of a sort of a CinemaScope film. And yeah, I wish people gave more credit to the co-director, Charlotte van der Meers, who has co-directed the film with Felix van Groningen, who's made many other films, and so people have been referring to it as his film, but I've seen his other films and they're not good. And this film is really good, so I could kind of have to imagine that that's thanks to Charlotte van der Meers. So, yeah, I really hope that that picks up some distribution and is able to find an audience, because it was really, really wonderful. And it was like a 2.5 hour epic that earned its runtime. It was actually well edited. I mean, it's not without its flaws, but on the whole, I'm pretty enthusiastic about it. A bit of a tearjerker. When we planned our season, we hadn't quite realized that there was actually going to be a special section at the festival on the official Olympic films. And I mean, we'll have a review of Naomi Kawase's film. There's actually two parts, and only the first part, Side A, screened at Cannes, and that's what we've seen. And Brett, our associate editor, has reviewed it. It should be live on the site by the time this is out. We were wondering if it was going to be propaganda or a Naomi Kawase film, and yeah, it's a Naomi Kawase film. There's lots of trees, and well, he describes it better than I will, but I think it's a film that's quite interested in women's stories. It follows a bunch of mothers at the Olympics. It's also interested in sort of the kind of ironies of it as like an intercultural exchange, and the ways that that doesn't happen. Like, there's one guy who is Iranian, but he left Iran for Germany and somehow ended up competing for Mongolia. And there's like a bunch of stories like that where people have kind of like multiple nationalities. And so it's sort of a weird thing of to still treat each country as sort of having borders when, you know, people immigrate and have multiple passports, and where is anyone really from anyway? It also shows some cross-cultural exchange of these two mothers meeting, and one mother is Canadian and she insisted that she be allowed to bring her baby with her to breastfeed at the Olympics, and one of the mothers is Japanese. They're both basketball players, and the Japanese one just wasn't able to compete in the Olympics because she didn't want to leave her baby. And when she meets the Canadian, she's just like flabbergasted that it could have even been an option, that she said, no, I'm going to breastfeed my baby and I'm going to be in the Olympics and just deal with it. So that was interesting. I don't think that it's like the greatest work of art, but it's definitely not just pure propaganda. It's got, and it falls into, I think, a lot of Naomi Kawase's interests. I know there's been, like you alluded to this in our Naomi Kawase episode previously, that there's been some controversy out about Naomi Kawase, and it's hard for us to really comment on it because it's generally not been reported in English language news sources, so we'd have to like Google Translate stories from Asian media, which seems like a recipe for broken telephone. So I mean, if we have listeners who, you know, are familiar with Japanese press and what all has been going on, we'd love to hear from you so we can get a better understanding of what's going on. I understand through the grapevine, and again, this is through the grapevine, so, but that some of her collaborators were coming out at Cannes saying, telling more stories about abuse and abusive behavior on set. So hard to know what that means for Naomi Kawase's career and what all that means, period, because again, I don't speak Japanese or Korean or Chinese or like, so I can't or any have any knowledge of any related languages, so I really can't you know, do proper research in those languages to suss out what's going on. So obviously mm-hmm. that's
a story in progress.
Yeah, a story in progress and concerning.
Yeah.
But, you know, the flip side of it is that, like, it wouldn't be such a big deal if, I mean, obviously abuse is a big deal. I don't mean that. But, like, it wouldn't be feel like such a blow to, like, you know, the advancement of women in film if Can programmed more than one female director over time. Yeah. Like, if we weren't just losing our one Can director that Can programs.
Regularly.
Yeah. So, yeah, so check out Brett's review. I think that's a good summary of the film.
Yeah. So that's it for our final episode of our Women in Cannes season of the Seventh Row podcast. We are going to go on hiatus for a few weeks now to prepare for our next season, which we hope to have out in late summer. So watch this feed for updates, and you can also, and I'd really recommend this, you can sign up for email updates in the show notes. We'll have a link there for you. That way you're never going to miss anything that we put out, and whether it's podcast or not at Seventh Row. Or go to email.seventh-row.com. So if you enjoyed this episode, please listen to the rest of our Women in Cannes season. And you might also enjoy checking out some of the older episodes of our podcast that are somewhat related. We've got loads of episodes about films that have been at Cannes, like our episode from this year about Joachim Trier's Worst Person in the World, or we did an episode last year about Mike Leigh's Naked, because it had a restoration released. And late last year we also did an episode on The Souvenir Part 1 and 2, which both of them screened in Out of Competition in Director's Fortnight last year. We're always covering films by and about women. One of our recent episodes was on a really wonderful Indigenous coming of age film, Run Woman Run. And we mentioned Ninja Baby in this episode, actually. We've done an episode on that and comparing it to Obvious Child. So I think if you're interested in the season, basically, we've got a lot of content you might be interested in. And all those episodes are free. Most of our episodes older than 6 months are members only, though. And that opens you up to a whole of other podcasts that are related to this one. Like our episode on Titan, our episode on Mia Hansen Loves Things to Come and Bergman Island, our episode on Cannes 2021. There's too many to name. So you can become a member at seventh-row.com/join, and that will get you all the perks to do with the podcast and other things. And once again, just a reminder that our sale for our book set with ebooks about Kelly Reichardt, Celine Siama, and Lynn Ramsey is still on until June 10th, so in a few days' time from the release of this episode. That's the Women in the Cannes Competition box set. And you can find that at seventh-row.com/womenatcannesboxset.
If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so by shooting us an email for a longer missive, contact@seventh-row.com, seventh-row.com. We will read your missives with great interest. You can also connect with us on Twitter and Instagram at Seventh Row, seventh-row. If you want to hear from us more often, make sure you're on our newsletter, email.seventh-row.com. And we would really appreciate it if you would rate and review the episode and the season if you've been enjoying it. That's it, though, for our Women in the Cannes Competition season. We hope you have enjoyed it, and stay tuned for our forthcoming season in a few weeks' time. Thanks for listening.